Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we're sitting down and having a conversation with Maryland's new 4th Congressional District Representative, freshman Congressman Anthony Brown. Of course, you remember he was Lieutenant Governor for the state of Maryland at one point. Also, a Maryland state delegate representing a part of Prince George's County. Well, tonight we're talking to him about all things presidential, all things going on Capitol Hill. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Sheila calling from Baltimore. Thanks for calling, Sheila. What's on your mind?
Hi, yes. I just have it's kind of like a question and statement regarding the health care program. I hear all the time about, you know, because the premiums are too high for the affordable health care that people can't afford it. However, the premiums are going up across the board, regardless if you have affordable health care or not. But when it comes to the college students, there's a reason, I'm assuming, why students cannot, or college students that graduated, that cannot pick up the affordable health care, because it probably has something to do with their extensive college loan that they have to pay back. So to try to balance both is probably why it's not affordable. So why no one seems to be talking or providing us with the reasons why the young adults are not electing this health care, when it's really probably because they can't really afford it because of the school loans.
And Sheila, I think you're certainly onto something. And in fact, if you look at President Trump's proposed budget, now his formal budget's not out, but his what they call skinny budget is out, and he's looking to make it worse. He's proposing a $6 billion cut to the Pell Grant program, and big percentage of students rely on the Pell Grant program to go to school. He's making cuts, making cuts there. He's making cuts to grants that are relied upon, particularly by historically black colleges and universities. Not only is there effort underway to sort of, repeal this health care, which is going to make it very expensive for young people, as well as the age tax for if you're over 55. But the other things that they're doing just compound and it makes it worse, like reducing cuts to the Pell Grant program. And these are the things that we're focused on. Democrats are focused on it. And just like we were successful last week in repelling the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, we're going to fight to make sure we don't see the kinds of cuts that the administration is proposing.
Okay. Sheila, thank you so much. Let's go to Eric calling from Southeast. Eric, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you all for having me.
Sure.
Congressman, I'm going to keep it real simple. I'm a 23-year-old black male from Washington, D.C., born and raised. I graduated from Old Dominion University. So I just want to know, man to man, just how do you feel, being a congressman and, you witnessing everything that's going on. You basically have a president who lies to your face and basically, and when asked about those lies, tries to cover it up, like, oh, I never said that, or you guys are twisting my words. Just off the record, I know you got a job to uphold. I know, by you having the position that you're in, there's certain things you can't really say. But I just want to know, is it just me who sits back and goes to sleep at night? Like, am I the only one who's going crazy and saying, like, I know he just said this, but then he's telling me that he didn't say this? Am I crazy for thinking this? Or as you as a congressman, do you feel the same way?
No, look, you're not crazy, and even if you were, you're not alone, because a lot of people view this president and the things that he said. Look, the members of the Congressional Black Caucus, about six of us, went to the White House last week, and we talked about a number of issues: criminal justice reform, summer jobs program, workforce development. But before we even got started, we wanted to make it clear to the president, and we took this opportunity to say, look, a lot of the things that you say, we just have serious issues with. The way that you mischaracterize the African-American community as if all of us live in poverty in inner cities,
right,
and not recognizing the diversity that we are. Yes, there are African-Americans that live in poverty, but there are also African-Americans that are successful business owners. We're farmers. We're college grads, just like yourself, Eric. And we wanted to educate him on that. We also told him that, you know, we thought it was offensive the way that he, you know, the things that he said about President Obama. So we called him out on it. Now, granted, we're in the White House and we're in the cabinet room, so you know, it was a diplomatic exchange, if you will.
Right, but we made
it very clear that that's unacceptable language, and many, including us, find it offensive.
Okay, right. Eric, thank you so much for your phone call. I want to talk a little bit more about that. What was his response when the meeting started off like that and you shared those things with him?
Well, so it was important for us that this was not just a photo op. So mm-hmm. we went to the White House and we expected and in fact did have a business meeting with the president. We sat down in the cabinet room. We later took it to the Oval Office. You know, he listened. You know, and he looked at each of us and seemed to, you know, he was receiving and acknowledging what we had to say. There was a, you know, modest exchange. There wasn't, you know, a whole lot of exchange. It was an opportunity for us to present to him and help him answer the question. You remember Harold on the campaign when he asked the African-American community, what do you have to lose?
Right.
So we wanted to help him answer that question. We talked about cuts to higher ed. We talked about, you know, the fact that his attorney general, for example, doesn't value and is not going to honor the consent decrees between the Department of Justice and local law enforcement to improve policing and police accountability. So we had an opportunity to present substantive issues that were important, that are important to the African-American community, and he listened. And, you know, only time will tell. One of the things that did come out of the meeting, we asked specifically for access to his cabinet secretaries, the Attorney General, you know, Dr. Carson at Housing, Betty DeVos at Education, and he agreed that he would make them available. So we've already sent letters from the CBC to those secretaries requesting an opportunity to meet with them.
Did he say anything else about support of HBCUs? There are a lot of folks that are burned and really salty about that photo op from a couple of weeks ago. And then, of course, in his budget, you could argue that his support was, the financial support was considerably less, not to mention cuts to, you know, to Pell Grants and the like.
Right. So the cuts to the Pell Grant, and that has a disproportionate impact on HBCUs. Higher percentage of students attending HBCUs are receiving Pell Grants. So there's a big hit there. There are a number of grant programs that are a benefit to HBCUs that are proposed to be cut. Now, in terms of the line item to the HBCUs, that's relatively level funded,
right?
And they seem to be excited about that. But we pointed out that level funding is insufficient because HBCUs have been historically underfunded. So level funding doesn't really get us to where we need to be.
Did he say anything about that at all? About possibly changing?
No, there wasn't much of an exchange. Mm. Again, there was a lot of listening on their part. I think we didn't expect to walk out of the meeting with, you know, dollar commitments for this program and that program. We wanted, number one, to you know, let them know, you know, what are the important issues, where are we on these issues, you know, make sure that we've got access to his team, because we're going to need to roll up our sleeves and engage his cabinet secretaries as they're developing their budgets, as they're developing their initiatives. And make a run at them.
Okay.
See how successful we can be.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking to Maryland Congressman Anthony Brown. Let's go to Connie calling from Windsor Mill. Go right ahead, Connie.
Hi, good evening. My question is, what can we do as citizens to seriously start impeachment? Because it seems that nothing that they're doing is proper. And when President Obama was in there, he had to cross every T and dot every I, and they still wanted to impeach him. Everything that he has set forth, they're trying to turn it back in our first 100 days. And this is going to impact us. It's already impacting people, seriously. I don't understand. I feel like I know we don't have the House or the Congress, but what can we do as citizens? Because this is greatly, greatly impacting us as citizens.
Congressman.
Right. So citizens really, and you know, don't have a direct input into an impeachment process. You elect members of Congress, and then Congress, under the Constitution, has certain responsibilities. And first and foremost, any president would have to be allegations or a charge made by the House of Representatives that the president engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors. And you know, as offensive as some of the
Hold on, Connie. Go right ahead, Congressman.
So, as offensive as the conduct and language may have been, as much as we disagree with the policies, now you got the whole Russian collusion investigation going on. You don't know what's going to come out of that. But where we stand today, you know, look, it's doubtful that you've got grounds for impeachment. But that's the process. So the House, and then there's a process. So right now, we're focused on, the policy proposals and resisting the effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act. The president's going to lay down a budget soon with big cuts. We've got to engage on that. There's going to be an infrastructure, bill. That we're all looking forward to, and we want to make sure that there's workforce development in there, that underserved communities get their share of the infrastructure dollars. So there's a lot of work ahead, and I don't know if impeachment is sort of on the top five agenda right now, because I don't think you got the high crimes and misdemeanor on the table.
Connie, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. I want to ask you about something that happened yesterday. The Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, was asked about the alleged rape at Rockville High School and the immigrant situation. And the next travel ban and all of these things. And he said he came out against the sanctuary state measure moving through Annapolis right now. He said Maryland would make a mistake. How do you come down on Maryland as a sanctuary state? Montgomery County, Prince George's County, sanctuary counties.
Yeah. And let me start by kind of taking on the first part of the question. I mean, look, this was tragic. A teenage girl at a Rockville High School is raped in the school. Rape is just a reprehensible, heinous act, regardless of the age of the victim and regardless of who the assailant is. And we need to do everything we can to make sure that we can minimize, if not eliminate, that. And when it does happen, that we prosecute to the full extent of the law whoever commits that crime, regardless of their immigration status. I mean, if you're a citizen in this country and you rape someone, we're going to come down with the full weight of the law. Mm-hmm. If you're an immigrant in this country and you have documentation, we're still going to come down with the full weight of the law. And if you're an immigrant in this country and you're undocumented, we're going to come down with the full weight of the law. If deportation is part of it, and we're satisfied that you'll get that kind of justice in your home country, then that's going to happen. So you know, this was a criminal offense, and we need to prosecute that crime. In terms of sanctuary cities and undocumented immigrants, look, I served as lieutenant governor, and I served in the state legislature, and I know that state and local law enforcement is strapped. I mean, there are not a whole lot of resources to do the job that they already need to do, keeping our streets safe, you know, doing appropriate community policing, focusing on the most violent offenders in our community, the whole piece. They're already overburdened. So to turn around and say, okay, Prince George County Police Department, we want to deputize you as immigration custom enforcement agents, they don't have the resources to do that. So we're asking them to do something that is going to take away from their primary mission, which is to catch that guy that did what he did in the Rockville High School, regardless of his immigration status.
Okay.
So we need to be focused on violent offenders and safe neighborhoods.
Need to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to continue our conversation with Maryland Congressman Anthony Brown, freshman congressman from Maryland's 4th Congressional District. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our conversation with Maryland's new 4th Congressional District Representative, freshman Congressman Anthony Brown. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Gwen, calling from Upper Marlboro, what's on your mind?
Hello, good evening.
Hi.
I just had a comment on the affordable health care. I heard the congressman saying there's still work to be done, and I know that because I'm one of those people who pay a high deductible to have health insurance and can't actually use it because the deductible is so high, so I'm paying like $15,000 a year in health insurance just to say that I have it but can't really use it.
Okay. Gwen, thank you so much. Go ahead. Go right ahead, Congressman.
Yep. And Gwen, we acknowledge that there are far too many Americans such as yourself that are coming out of pocket or having to come out of pocket, whether it's deductibles, co-pays, co-insurance. Premiums are still high for too many. Prescription drug prices are too high. Look, the Democrats, we are going to put forward a proposal to improve the Affordable Care Act. It's not going to look anything like what the Republicans have put forward. Under the Republican plan, 24 million Americans would have been without insurance, and while premiums would have gone up over the first 2 years, veterans would have been shoved into an already overburdened VA hospital system. If you were between jobs for more than 63 days, you'd pay a 30 and without insurance, you'd pay a 30% penalty when you pick up insurance again. So we all know that we have to improve it. What you saw last week wasn't the answer. We're going to be putting a proposal down pretty soon.
When should we expect to see something like that coming from the Democrats?
Harold, I'm going to tell you like it is. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm a new member in Congress. I've got my ideas on how on the things that we need to do to bring down costs, to spread the risk pools. And this, I can assure you one thing: we're not going to do it the way that the Republicans did it. We're not going to try to to hurry it up. We're not going to do it without the benefit of hearings and input. When you look at the plan that was rejected last week, the Hospital Association was against it, the Physicians Association was against it, AARP was against it, because they didn't even have a seat at the table to design this thing. So it doesn't happen overnight.
Okay.
So I don't want to, this evening promise a date that is not deliverable.
Okay. Thank you so much, Gwen. Let's go to Carla calling from Northwest. Carla, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Okay, thank you for taking my call. I want to know, what do you think about the massive federal cuts that President Trump has proposed for the federal government and the loss of jobs for thousands of federal employees? And how is that going to, just affect our economy if you have thousands of people that are, slated to lose their jobs because of the massive budget cut?
Right. So with the budget cuts, and a study was recently done with the proposed budget cuts, and I don't know the exact numbers, but, the overall income in this area is going to drop by several percentages. Home values are going to drop in the national capital region, but in addition to that, the loss of jobs, the impact on the housing market, the cuts in services. There are going to be longer lines at airports trying to get through TSA. Seniors waiting for that Social Security check, longer lines. Veterans waiting for services, longer lines. It's going to have a dramatic impact, not just in this area, but around the country. Carla, what happens is Republicans run for office and they say that government's the problem, okay, and it ought to be reduced and minimized. And then when they win, they set out to deprive government of all the resources needed to deliver the services that we expect and we deserve. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because then government is no longer effective because they're starving it. And then they turn around and say, look at government, it's not effective.
Okay.
Yeah.
Carla, thank you so much for your phone call.
Thank you. Just want to know, what can we do as constituents to let congressmen and senators know that we don't like this, proposed budget cut? What can we do?
Absolutely. Write letters, visit them in their offices, and if use your Rolodex, your network of folks that live in states and congressional districts where Republicans are representing them in Congress, and have them write letters. Because you can send me a letter all day long, and but you'll be preaching to the choir. I like getting your letters, Carla. I enjoy reading them, and my staff does as well. But if you really want to have an impact, we need to be writing Republican members of Congress, both the House and the Senate. And typically a member is going to open up a letter from their constituents. So, look at your Rolodex. Who do you know in a Republican district, a Republican state, and help them write the letter. Say, hey, let's send this letter to your Republican senator.
Carla, thank you so much for your phone call. I have a question. One of the things that impressed me last week was the solidarity of the Freedom Caucus. Even though we know behind closed doors there were divisions even within the caucus, where do you believe the CBC, the Congressional Black Caucus, can show that kind of solidarity and make some moves within the Democratic side of the aisle, as well as the next piece of major legislation coming down?
Right. So, look, the Freedom Caucus is made up of, the most conservative of conservative members. They're true to their conservative values, and they spoke with one voice on this for the most part. I think there were a few dissenters among their group. But they used the power of their numbers to block what was going down last week. I think the Congressional Caucus can and has on a number of issues. I think about voting rights. While the Voting Rights Act was passed in the 1960s, it's always under assault. And I think that we do speak with one voice on protecting voter rights. I think criminal justice reform, things like reentry programs, the Second Chance Act. We certainly speak on one voice. But the Congressional Black Caucus, we are 49 strong. It's the largest number in the history of the Congress. And there are two African American members who have chosen not to be in the caucus. And we are a diverse group of members. We represent collectively 78 million people. About 25% are African American. So 75% are everybody else. So we're not monolithic. We're not homogenous. We're not on one accord on every single issue. But there are issues where we speak with one voice, and two of which I just pointed out: voting rights and criminal justice reform, and certainly support to for affordable college education. We are pretty much in lockstep on those issues.
Okay, Roxy, calling from Sykesville, what's on your mind, Roxy?
Oh, hi. How's everybody?
Just fine, thank you.
Great.
Hi, Roxy.
Pardon me?
I was just saying hello.
Okay, hi. And congratulations on your win. I have a question as to, now that I really think the Democrats have proved the point on the Affordable Health Care Act, because it took over 10 years to get it to where it is. But my question is, has there been a change in the mindset and thinking about health care based on a wellness model as opposed to an health/insurance/doctor's model? Because that's all based on economics and finance. And I think if we could remove some of the money out of the health care, because you would pay people to be well. But that's a totally different mindset, wellness is, than health care. Has anybody thought about that on the Democratic side?
Roxy, we have, and not only have we thought about it, but there are provisions in the Affordable Care Act. You know, often when you hear about the Affordable Care Act, there are a few sort of like three or four, you know, buzzwords that you hear, you know, pre-existing condition or, you know, coverage up to age 26 and enhanced Medicaid. But there are a lot of other provisions in the Affordable Care Act that are very patient-centered, where there are incentives to switch to, you know, reimbursements based on value and not fee-for-service. That's good for patients, and quite frankly, most physicians would like to go to that. You know, pay a doctor or a healthcare provider for keeping me healthy, not for the procedures that they do. And that is very patient-centered. There are provisions in there that incentivize hospitals to reduce readmissions, right? Because, you know, there was a time when hospitals, hey, you know, bring them through the door. We get paid for cycling people through. Well, we're moving away from that and saying, no. If you have a readmission, you're not getting the reimbursement like you used to on the readmission, because they shouldn't be coming back to you in the first place. So there are provisions.
I understand that, but wellness is totally different, and it's even different in the language that it used. As long as you're using language like patient, you're still under health care, and you're still making your money based on someone being sick and not getting well, because it's the medical practice, and you can't even use a four-letter word called cure, and you can't use the word called heal. But in wellness, those words are being used, and we know by documentation and data that there are ways in wellness that get people off of medicines, and so you can affect the pharmaceutical world, because that's another mm-hmm. big component that costs money.
Well, Roxy, I've got to let you go because I'm out of time, but certainly you've given all of us something to think about. And like you said, Congressman, there were provisions in the ACA when you're talking about, you know, dealing with, you know, examinations, you know, breast exams, prostate exams, and all of those things.
All preventative services.
Exactly.
No co-pays. There are a lot of things that focus on wellness, because, Roxy, we know that 20% of the patient population consumes 80% of the healthcare dollars, because we're trying to manage their chronic illnesses and diseases.
I'm out of time. I apologize, but we look forward to having you on again. Good luck, Congressman.